Welcome. This is Layla Benitez James for the Asymptote Podcast. It's been a little while, and I'm really excited to be jumping back into some new episodes, especially as so much has been happening with our Asymptote Journal. With writing and art from 29 countries, including a stunning Korean fiction feature, our spring issue came out in April, and it is bursting with wonderfully, beautifully strange writing. As a poet, I'm usually quick to dive right into that section, and there are some fantastically experimental works in this issue. Though it was Gabriel Bernal Granado's essay on Thomas Aikens, translated by Roberto Tejada, that really captured my imagination with its captivating commentary on Aikens' haunting paintings of boxing rings and operating theaters, this issue is not one to be missed. If you are already enamored with the new issue and want to get involved with the journal, lovers of world literature are encouraged to apply for various staff positions that are now open as we are happily expanding our team yet again. You can join Asymptote's intrepid literary explorers, but time is running out. Just a few more days left to apply before our Monday, June 18th deadline. The first magazine to win the London Book Fair Award for International Literary Translation Initiative, our team comprises close to 100 staffers across 6 continents, and runs thanks to dedicated creatives who are plugged into their local scenes. A perk of becoming part of this community is to be continually deepening your knowledge of both local and global literature by becoming connected with people who share your passion across the globe. Head to Asymptote website to find more details about how to apply. There you will also find news of our fourth edition of Close Approximations, Asymptote's international translation contest. Open to emerging translators, this contest invites translations in 2 genres, fiction and poetry. The winner and 2 runners-up in each category will respectively receive $1,000 and $250 worth of prizes. That includes a 1-year Asymptote Book Club subscription, in addition to winning a series prize money. Our winner will also be featured in our Winter 2019 issue, joining an exceptional roster of translators published in our pages. Even if you are not the winner of this year's Close Approximations Prize, you can still enjoy all the perks of Asymptote's newly launched book club, which delivers carefully selected fiction right to your doorstep. Committed to featuring a wide variety of translators and source texts, you'll discover exciting new works by emerging voices and beloved authors while reading from all over the globe. It also makes a wonderful gift. In the spirit of reading more from all over the globe, I too have been trying to fill some major holes in my own personal library. While devouring many craft essays to aid in my own translation practice, I came across translator and writer John Keane's Translating Poetry, Translating Blackness. The essay affected me so much, I printed it out and carried it around with me for nearly a year, pulling it out and rereading whenever I felt the need. It gathered some coffee stains and folds through the pages, but what I was unable to put down was Keane's compelling call for more translation of literary works by non-Anglophone Black diasporic authors into English. As a writer of color, I was familiar with these ideas, yet had not heard them put so elegantly in terms of translation. I remembered that one aspect that had drawn me to Asymptote in the first place was its great diversity of writers. As a writer of color, I was familiar with these ideas, yet had not heard them put so elegantly in terms of translation. I remembered that one aspect that had drawn me to Asymptote in the first place was its great diversity of writers, languages, and countries of origin, and the fact that its mission seemed to be to keep going, keep growing, and keep widening that net. There are thousands of reasons I see value in that kind of work, but especially with political events taking such dark turns in my own country of origin, the United States, as well as others, the idea of expanding knowledge is crucial. More than just cultural benefit, Keane talks about the societal benefits of translation, saying, "Were more Black voices translated, we would have a clearer sense of connections and commonalities, as well as the differences across the African diaspora. We have a truer and fuller sense of the globe when we have translations of the vast majority of work out there. When I thought about my own reading list, I could list few titles beyond the big names which hold rank among Things Fall Apart. Luckily, a wonderful book was about to cross my path from a country I'd read nearly nothing from, Equatorial Guinea. After moving to Spain in fall of 2014, I started crossing paths, online, with a translator who had lived in Madrid since 1999. As well as being a translator, Lawrence Schimmel writes in both Spanish and English and has published over 100 titles as author or anthologist, in various genres and for all ages. His collection of stories written in Spanish, Una Barba para Dos, had delighted me the year before, and I was not surprised to learn that his writing had been translated into over 30 languages. Though we tried to meet up a few times, our respective schedules seemed determined not to let it happen until we thought we would finally overlap in January of 2017. Again, things didn't work out, but he let me know that he was working on an exciting new project, a lesbian feminist novel from Equatorial Guinea. While I had never yet read anything from that country, months later in September at the Afro Conciencia Festival in Madrid, I would be introduced to the work of Inongo V. Makome, beginning to open a tiny crack to widen my reading. Fast forward to May of this year, and I was reading a review in Asymptote blog of Trifonia Melbea's La Bastarda, the novel Schimmel had been working on. Brilliant in its own right, with a thrilling first sentence, the novel is also surrounded with the added weight of being the first novel by a female author from Equatorial Guinea, translated into English, happening to be published as well after the country celebrated 50 years of independence from Spain. For more information about the book, I highly recommend a read of Parker Brookie's review in the blog, and I'll also add that the novel pleasantly surprised me with the wonderfully dry humor which I found present in online interviews with Melbea herself. ¿Qué sabemos en España de Guinea? She's asked. What do they know of Guinea and Spain? Poco, she says, very little, before adding, bueno, no quiero exagerar, nada. Well, I don't want to exaggerate, they know nothing. A little over a year ago, I could have counted myself in that boat as well, but Melbea's writing makes for a painless and wildly enjoyable corrective, helping me to understand more about how the project found its way into English. Schimmel was kind enough to sit down with me for the podcast. After we agreed to meet, I realized that he had also recently been a part of a panel with John Keane, inspired by that very essay, talking about what translators and publishers alike could do to bring more voices into the sphere of English. After fleeing from a bumping DJ in the Cafe of the Reina Sofia and searching out a quiet spot amidst the Saturday lunchtime herds of Madrid, we eventually found a little bright blue modernist corner in the Cine Lore for our conversation.
Thank you so much for agreeing to have a little conversation for the Asymptote podcast. First off, I wanted to ask you how you got started with this project and how you found this writer.
So La Bastarda was the first book published by a new feminist publisher here in Madrid called Flores Raras. And I knew the woman who runs the press and was interested in the work that she was doing. And so I read the book when it was published. I liked it. I asked if I could try and place it in the English language as a translator. So first I translated one of the chapters, and Words Without Borders published it in their queer issue. And then I used that as a sample to go to publishers and interest publishers from it. So it was interesting because I wound up meeting Melibea after I had already translated the novel, since she's in Malabo. She does come through Madrid a lot, especially when she has new books out in Spanish, but I hadn't had a chance to meet her in person until after the first draft of the translation had been done, but before the book was published.
And so at that point, did you get to ask her questions and kind of have her clarify any points that you had with the first draft, or was it kind of set?
I went over the experience of translating the book was very interesting for me, especially trying to unpack all of the layers of colonialism, of being a white American translator, translating a African, black, queer voice. So there were a lot of things, and most of that I discussed with my editor, Lauren Hook, at the Feminist Press, and so we did a lot of layers of, you know, in the book, Meli Bey uses the term curandera, and I was like, okay, it's really problematic to just say witchcraft, even though witch doctor, even though that is the term that's being used. And so I had advocated that we leave it as curandera in the, you know, in the English translation, to just call it, to just leave the word in Spanish as a way of not using a very loaded term. I didn't talk to Meli Bey much about the questions. Most of the questions were things where we knew what they were, but we're trying to figure out how to convey them in the English translation. Some other examples, the different characters in the book, when they talk about menstruation, do so differently than would be in English. So the way that the grandfather or the grandmother talk about Okomo, that when she starts menstruating, then she suddenly becomes valuable to them as a woman that they can marry off to someone who has money. And so that was one way of talking about that, which is very different than when Okomo and the other girls talk about it, you know. So, but we also had to be careful, because those are terms that are either very regional or very dated, or very different age groups would talk very differently about them. So it was sort of, how could we find ways of saying it that had the same naturalness that that Meli Bey uses in the book. And that was also one thing that I had really fought for, that because of the colonialism involved, so Meli Bey wrote the novel in Spanish, which is her daily language, even though there is a lot of Fang terminology, there's a sprinkling of Fang words in the book, which I thought we should gloss, that is to explain within the context in the translation, but leave in Fang. But I also fought to have some Spanish left in the English translation so that it still had that same texture.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the title being La Bastarda, that gendering in Spanish that you just don't have in English.
So the title, actually, I was against using the La Bastarda. I thought it could be The Bastarda, but I was afraid that calling La Bastarda, that in American bookstores it would be thought to be a book in Spanish as opposed to a book translated from Spanish. So that was one where they thought it was better to leave, you know, the publishing department and the, you know, to leave it as La Bastarda. I thought that The Bastarda would have been better. But the lack of gender terms was something that we sort of had to try and work out. But what I was saying earlier about the language is that the Spanish spoken in Equatorial Guinea sounds archaic in many ways to modern Spanish. That is, they still sound like the Spanish that was used when they stopped being a colony on some levels. So it's slightly, the book has a slightly formal tone to it that I wanted to make sure that, you know, was preserved. Even though it's a 16-year-old protagonist, I didn't want it to be full of likes and contractions. And so, I talked with my editor about that, and Lauren agreed with me. And so we just had to make sure that the copy editor, after we had done the edit together, that the copy editor didn't suddenly, you know, convert all of the something of something into apostrophe S. And so it has a slightly more old-fashioned feel to it, to preserve that texture of the language in the original, in the book. I also, one of the terms that we left in Spanish was that in the dialogue, the terms of endearment, so Okomo is a bastard, her mother died in childbirth, and the father had never paid the bride price to the mother's tribe, and so she belongs to her grandfather's family. But then everyone calls her hija, which is a term of endearment, but she's not the actual daughter of any of the people who call her hija. So I said we should leave hija, abuelo, abuela, all of those terms in Spanish in the dialogue, but not outside of the dialogue. So, you know, my grandfather, my grandmother, and then abuelo, abuela. So it's, the context is all given. So, I mean, it's never, people who don't speak Spanish will understand what's going on, because we contextualize everything. And instead of using footnotes, we added a clause between commas explaining what the Fang terms were, so that it was integrated into the novel rather than having a footnote at the bottom explaining what the Mintangan are, for instance.
Yes, I was just about to ask about the Mintangan. I appreciated, even though I actually really love footnotes often, but I appreciated that there weren't footnotes, and it was just kind of like you got from context and you had to put yourself more into that world, if you will, than scrolling down and looking at it.
No, it was a wonderful process, the editing process with Lauren Hook at the Feminist Press. We had long Skype conversations where we would go over again and again all of the different questions we had, and that's something that I haven't always had the privilege or the pleasure of having that detailed and that much care put into how the book is working on all levels, you know, to the micro. We kept coming back to some of the terms, and especially some of the terms that might, or the issues that were possibly problematic, as I mentioned earlier. You know, especially I was very aware, being a white male American translating a black woman from Africa, and not wanting to be, or wanting to be aware of that and aware of my own blind spots, you know, and so not trusting myself on a lot of things.
At the same time, that's so amazing that it almost forces you to do such careful work. Part of why I was drawn to talking about this book was after reading John Keane's poetry translating Blackness, and just that idea that it's really great to broaden the world and to broaden our concept of blackness and to broaden our concept of, you know, what narratives can exist in what countries, but that I guess the stage we are as translators, it also means that you're combing over things to see what words are loaded and how they're loaded and how you might, you know, translate them responsibly in English, even more so than the normal anxieties of a translator.
No, this is something that, I mean, especially as a Spanish-English translator, and I'm a curious case where I translate in both directions, but one of the new conventions is to use, for instance, Latin X, or to substitute the X for los and las, which then gets lost in a gender-neutral or a more gender-neutral language like English. So I've wound up translating a number of writers through English as a bridge language, taking part in a number of workshops, poetry workshops through Literature Across Frontiers, and then also working directly with some Baltic poets translating from Estonian or from Latvian into Spanish. And I need to work with the poets to find out, you know, if the English bridge translation says teacher, I need to know, is it a maestra or maestro, you know, male or female teacher. And so, you know, I'm hyper aware of gender in Spanish, which is my daily language here in Madrid, and also working as a translator, as a writer, and the different ways. Spanish doesn't have as much of the gender neutral pronouns that are becoming more popular, or more the awareness of gender-neutral pronouns or how we're using gender is very different between the different languages. There's also the conventions between what's accepted in Spanish and what would not be accepted in English are also very different. There was a children's novel I had translated, The Treasure of Barracuda, where one of the characters was, it was a pirate crew, and one was just called El Negro. And I was like, okay, we can't do this in a young adult novel in the U.S. of just calling a character Blackie or El Negro,
yeah.
Especially because all of the other characters had, as their nickname, the country they were from. And so in that case, I did go back to the author and I said, look, even if it's historically accurate, because she said, but I have, you know, these log books that, you know, call him El Negro. And I said, that's fine. But in today's culture, in this market, we're not going to be able to.
For the market as well, yeah, just being so conscious of where it's going. Well, that seemed especially interesting, too, for La Bastarda, because, you know, it, on the one hand, it's so momentous that it's this first book, and it surprised me that there just hadn't been a woman before translated into English. But it was also really exciting that it was also a queer woman talking about queer issues, and it seems like there's just so many things, there were so many things overlapping.
I mean, it is the first woman writer from Equatorial Guinea to be translated into English. I don't think it's as surprising. I mean, I was surprised when I realized that, but I don't think it's as surprising just given how much more difficult it is for women's voices to be translated into English in general. The press that I run, A Midsummer Night's Press, we started an imprint in 2014 called Periscope that only publishes women poets in translation, because the two previous years, all translations from all languages, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, only 26% were by women writers. Those numbers haven't really gone up that much. It's different in different genres, but there's a lack of women's voices that are not coming in to, especially into English, but in general, it's much more difficult for women writers to wind up being translated than it is for male writers. As a translator, this was something that I was aware of, that it was much easier for me to place the projects by male writers than it was to place the projects by women writers, by and large. At the same time, the different countries, especially the Spanish language, is rather misogynistic still, very machismo, and that's reflected in the funding bodies. And so Mexico, for instance, no longer has the FONCA translation program, but the last year that it had it, I think of the 60 grants that were awarded, only 9 were awarded to books by women. So
wow.
There's a huge imbalance. Not all countries are like that. Argentina, for instance, I will say, is very egalitarian. It's their program gives smaller amounts of money, but to more projects, and it doesn't matter if you're Cortázar or if you're a 16-year-old woman poet in Ushuaia, which is the end of the last habited place in Patagonia. If you're an Argentine writer, they will support the same amount. Everything is equal.
Right.
So that is one of the few places that has supported a lot, especially a lot of women writers from Argentina. But in general, it's much harder for women's voices to be published, and women of color even more so.
Exactly. When I was surprised reading interviews with her as well, that she was mentioning just how I didn't realize that the state of publishing in Equatorial Guinea was also so precarious or non-existent, and that
it's not precarious, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, yeah.
There is no publishing, there's no bookstores, there's no
barrier of, like, you know, you have to publish. You mentioned Argentina, you have to publish in Argentina, you have to publish in Spain, and so it's like there's this extra hurdle that you're having to jump over. Never mind being woman, never mind being queer, never mind being, you know, any of those other.
But I think also that's one of the things that Melibe is so savvy about, is that she knows she's writing about Equatorial Guinea for a foreign audience, because she has to publish abroad, but she doesn't do, or she's very savvy, I think, about the way that she presents things. So she's very understated about a lot of things, and that, I think, is a good thing. There's some writers who I think would do more armchair tourism, and she's not doing armchair tourism of come look at my country. She's writing from within about life there, but without sensationalizing the situation.
Yes.
There's one thing, I don't know if I can talk about it because I think it's a spoiler, so I don't know. So La Bastarda is the story of Okomo and various other characters challenging the patriarchal polygamous Fang culture. And one thing that I think for a lot of Western readers that's surprising or shocking about the book is how the main character, as her coming-of-age story evolves and as she discovers her own sexuality, her first encounter is with 3 other women at the same time, so in this polygamous introduction to her sexuality as a lesbian. And it's completely unsensationalized by the writer. Even, you know, she knows that she's writing this for a Western audience that's going to be shocked by this, and she's very careful to do it from within the normality of the culture. And so that's something that she handles, I think, very well. To write from within, even knowing that she's writing for a foreign audience.
Yeah, that scene was very striking, and it was very understated. I don't think we have to worry about spoilers.
Okay.
Small ones. But I remember. I think the emotions of that scene, which is like that she felt strange and a little bit bad, but like then everything else, nothing else, is sensationalized, and it was very striking.
But it was from within her culture, so it wasn't feeling bad about the threesome, the foursome, the other 3 women. What she was feeling bad about was that she has all of this societal and familial pressure to get a rich boyfriend,
right,
so that she can support the family, and, you know, and that her desires go against what she's been raised and taught to believe. So it was the internal coming out to herself, that, you know, these desires that she's been denying, not the fact that it's a foursome.
Right.
Which,
yeah,
for the,
yeah,
you know, the Western reader has read other coming out stories, but has, you know, not really had a foursome with a 16-year-old girl character.
Yeah, the shame, it's like economic and familial, instead of the kind of United States coming out narrative. It would be like the homophobia and all this kind of stuff, but it wouldn't really be a very practical level, which is what she was thinking about, of like, I need to provide these certain things for my family, and I'm not doing a good job.
No, I mean, the whole women as economy that Melibe denounces in the book is something that I think is so important, and especially the sort of, as the book evolves and the consequences when they're found out personally, and economically for all of them is something that's so important. And just, you know, the way that the Fang Society just treats women as by their monetary value and how much they're worth, and all of the participants in that, the, you know, her grandmother, who's always, you know, shaving her eyebrows and trying to pimp her off, you know, she's like, there's some rich politician coming, you know, you've got to get, you know, she makes her up, you know, puts makeup on her, which Okomo hates, and you know, the grandmother literally drags her around and, you know, tries to pimp her off or use her status as a bastarda. So because she belongs to the tribe, she doesn't have a father, but any male in the tribe, she can go up to them and say, Papa, I'm hungry, give me food, and they have to. And so Okomo is embarrassed to do this, but the grandmother forces her to do it to get money and food out of the other men in the tribe. So there's a lot of venal instincts or yeah, economics in play, especially because of the rivalry between Okomo's grandmother and the younger, newer wife that her grandfather has.
Right. And so I wanted to ask you, too, about just about that panel that was at AWP, and how, maybe what aspects were you guys discussing? Was it more, you know, getting these writers in the English or creating space?
It was an interesting panel. There were five of us on the panel with John Keane as the moderator, since it had all sort of, the launching point was his essay on translating blackness. It was interesting. I was a very weird case compared to the other four participants, because all of them were translating Afro-descendant writers from French, Brazilian Portuguese, or from Spanish, especially Caribbean writers. And I've actually only translated African writers. The black writers that I've translated have all been from Africa. Melibeya for La Bastarda, translating from Spanish into English from Equatorial Guinea. And I've actually translated a writer from Benin who lives in Barcelona. Her name is Agnes Agboton.
She writes in Spanish.
She writes in Gun originally. All her poetry she writes in Gun originally, and then self-translates into Spanish and publishes bilingual editions. And she was the representative from Benin for the Poetry Parnassus that was held in London during the London Olympics. And so I had translated into English through the Spanish as the bridge language, because there are no Gun to English literate translators, some of her work, and then we had long phone conversations where she would recite the poem so I could hear the music, and then I would read the English, and then we would make changes so that, and some of those were published in Modern Poetry and Translation, the British journal. And so in those cases, I've translated two black African writers into English and then into Spanish. I've also translated an anthology of lesbian and bisexual women from Zimbabwe called Like the Untouchable Wind, and a new book that's coming out later this fall, which is the collection Collective Amnesia by the poet and theater writer Koleka Putuma from South Africa. So it was interesting, the differences that we had of our different experiences translating African descendant writers, or in my case, African writers. And I think there is a difference between writers who are from Africa versus the Afro-descendant. I mean, the way those writers are perceived, I think, in the literary world is different. And it was also interesting, we shared a lot in common, especially those of us who were white translators translating Afro-descendant authors. There's some things, for instance, in Like the Untouchable Wind, there's one poem that was called Angry Black Woman. And, you know, very often we are the voice in the language. So when we did the launch in Spanish, I can't read that poem out loud, Angry Black Woman, as a white man. You know, I mean, it's just sort of, I'm not going to do that, you know, blackface, even though I could do it literally. And I think that, you know, the importance, what agency I have as a translator, as a publisher, to try and correct some of these imbalances, these are projects that I actively look for and advocate and try and do what I can to bring these voices into, in one direction or the other. So, I mean, there are things I'm very aware of, but there's also limitations to what I can do. I don't pretend to be or think that I'm the great white savior of African literature, either Equatorial Guinean into English or, you know, African writers into Spanish. You know, I mean, that's not my aim, but, you know, if I can, you know, I think as a gay man, I'm aware of not being part of the heteronormative uber culture and the many ways that I've not fit in have made me aware of other people who also don't fit in, and ways that we can try and address that and correct that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and it really is a kind of like common cause. Having experience in one kind of like side of things, it does make you want to bring in as many voices as you can and have that.
I mean, for me, when I first moved to Spain 20 years ago, it was a shock where I thought that I would have problems being an openly gay man in such a Catholic country, but I was actually, what was more shocking to more people were they had homosexuals here. That was not new to them, but I was the first Jew that a lot of people ever met in person, and to me that was something that I was like, oh, you know, because being Jewish is an identity that I was born with, I didn't actively choose, and I wasn't experiencing the type, back then I wasn't experiencing the type of anti-Semitism, which unfortunately is much more prevalent in today's society, both in the US and here in Spain. You know, I was more afraid of being openly gay, and, you know, they knew what homosexuals were, that wasn't an issue, but, you know, to me it was shocking, you know, to be in my 20s, coming from New York, where everyone... You know, I mean, Dunkin' Donuts had done, they'd introduced bagels and had used the Yiddish tagline of they're worth the schlep instead of they're worth the trip. You know, so like everyone speaks a little bit of, you know, Yiddishkeit in New York. So I was not, I was completely shocked to be in a place for the first time where, you know, people just didn't know what a Jew was. The language also, I mean, you know, we talked a little bit before about how sexist or machista the language can be in different cultures, but the uber... Catholicism in Spanish is also something that's really strong. And I mean, here in Spain, if you sneeze, they say Jesus, Jesus, you know, and it's sort of like, okay, that's not really relevant for me, or to say goodbye, adios, vaya con Dios, you know, there's these vestiges that people aren't necessarily aware of. The same when I was studying a little bit of Spanish sign language, and the month of April, and this is something on a podcast is difficult, but it's taking the middle finger and pointing to the palm of both hands, and that's the symbol for the stigmata. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just this uber Catholicism.
It is extremely...
extremely present linguistically,
and
also
physical.
in the culture and how people think, because it's, you know, even they used to call Spanish Cristiano. You know, they asked me if I had books that were translated into Cristiano, into Spanish. That was a, you know, a nickname for the Spanish language. So, you know, I was, you know, these are all layers. So I think that when I was translating something like La Bastarda, I'm aware of trying to unpack all of those layers. Do I always succeed? Probably not. I'm sure that I don't. You know, I mean, these are the limitations we all have. Hopefully, though, I'm aware of them and more aware of them as I continue to work and to translate and to read.
Well, I was wondering too, like, since you do have so much time in Spain, like, how do you see the publishing landscape here? Because having the time that I have, it seems like it's not... I mean, it's a completely different country than the United States, so you can't compare. But even with, say, France, I would say that the publishing landscape is not quite as diverse, and I'm not sure what...
Not as diverse in Spain.
Not as diverse in Spain.
Right. There's different types of diversity, though. I mean, I think that in terms of... race, there's much less attention to diversity in Spain than there is in France, for instance. I think also that there's a stronger relationship between France and ex-colonies in that way, whereas Spain, even with sharing language with most of Latin America, doesn't share culture back and forth. They like to still, they still have a very colonial mindset where they export books from Spain to Latin America, but they're still resistant to importing from Latin America here. And you see it, I mean, there are lots of books that during the dictatorship in Spain, everything was translated, you know, all of the great world literature, all of the translations were being done in, and also publishing of Spanish writers, in Argentina and in Mexico. And so there's older books that are, you know, translated with the peculiarities of those languages, you know, the Spanish language as it's spoken in Argentina or in Mexico, and I've come across lots of Spanish readers who don't want to read books that were translated in Latin America. So there's still a lot of resistance to that. I had it where, in my most recent book, which I had translated, which I didn't translate, I wrote directly in Spanish. It was 100 erotic microfiction, and I had wanted to use sexual slang from the other side of the Atlantic, and my publishers said, no, this is a Spanish publishing house, we're going to use all.
Really?
Yeah. I was allowed in one story, which use the bomba, the Argentine mate, as a metaphor, and it was just so particular to Argentina that we had to be able to use, you know, Argentine slang for sexual anatomy there. But, you know, in general, everything else was translated from Latin American Spanish into Peninsular Iberian Spanish. As a writer, I mean, as someone who writes in both Spanish and English, I've often written, especially a lot of children's books that were then published in Latin America, and very often they'll adapt the language to, you know, because I, after 20 years in Spain, I speak Iberian Spanish, even though I translate writers from all over the Spanish-speaking world, Latin America, Africa, Spain, even Spanish speakers in the U.S. So, you know, there's a rich variety of Spanishes that have come through my hands, and I'm aware of that when I'm writing. But, you know, something as simple as glasses, you know, they're gafas, anteojos, lentes, so country to country, the same word has different terminology. Most recently, it was interesting, I published two poetry collections that I translated into Spanish of Baltic writers for the Women's Press in Chile, Cuarto Propio. And we had interesting discussions because they adapted the language to Chilean Spanish, and there were some things that, there was one in particular, there was a line of she stood on her own 2 feet, and I had said se valió por sí mismo, which was a positive thing, and they had used se paró sobre los pies, because for them to stand up is to pararse sobre los pies, but to me pararse was a negative, it was a
stopping.
It was a stopping, and so I didn't like that edit because the connotation was negative as opposed to this positive standing up. So it was an interesting debate.
Thank you so much.
Later that night, I went to a free screening for Molly Blues at Madrid's huge, sprawling art space, the Matadero, followed by a one-woman performance, No Es Un País Para Negras, directed by Carolina Torres de Baga, and starring Silvia Albert Sopave, which explores the experiences of a Spanish-born Black woman and touched on things I too had experienced growing up in Austin, Texas. Just one shared element being asked repeatedly where we were really from, then where our parents were from. And I found myself laughing at sharing this with someone born thousands of miles away and on a different continent. Returning to King's essay, he speaks about a call to reconfigure how we think about the world, our neighbors, our sisters, our brothers, and ourselves, to see, to listen, to pay attention in new ways, to continue developing lines of exchange. He goes on, the more voices we open our ears to, read, and hear, acknowledging that the bridges we construct through translation will not be foolproof, the less likely we are to misunderstand and thus erase or elide particularities and specificities, and the more likely we are to see connections and commonalities at the same time. That is, we have nothing to lose and everything to gain by doing this good work. One of the most inspiring things I took away from the essay is that while a lack of perspective is a long-standing and continuing problem, it's also a wonderful challenge for translators to address, and one that many are taking on. While I feel like I have barely scratched the surface of this topic, it's safe to say the doors have been opened, and I'll just say that coming soon are more conversations with more translators taking up the call, along with writers letting us into their worlds. Don't forget our Close Approximations contest is open until December 1st, and we especially welcome contemporary work translated from underrepresented languages. If you want to get involved directly and join our team, get online now for more information about our recruitment call closing soon, and know that you can always become a sustaining member of the journal at any time in just a few clicks. Until next time, this is Leila Benitez-James signing off for the Asymptote Podcast.